Good evening, everyone. Welcome again to Keble College. Some of you might have been in the earlier talk that Tim Winter gave earlier on Islam and gender, but there's some who probably are here for the first time. This particular session is sponsored by Keble College Chapel, and in a series called the Sanctorum and Jesus and Abrahamic Faith. And we're looking at different speakers to talk about Jesus in Jewish faith, Jesus in Muslim faith today, and then later on somebody else will be here to talk about Jesus in Christian faith, of course. Very honored and privileged to have Tim Winter this evening. It is all the way from Cambridge in this weather. It's quite, I was a bit worried that whether he was going to make it or not, but I'm very, very glad and really appreciate that he has made it this evening of today for actually two talks back to back. It's quite a rather demanding schedule. I would like to now actually hand over the mic to Sazan, who has also helped arrange this event as well, making connections with Tim Winter and all that. So would you hand over the mic to Sazan to introduce actually him properly to this group.
Hi, welcome, thanks for coming. This is the second time I'm going to do this today. Okay, so we're very happy to have Tim Winter with us this evening. He's one of Islam's leading thinkers today. He's the Sheikh Zayed Lecturer of Islamic Studies in the Faculty of Divinity at Cambridge University and the Director of Studies in Theology at Wolfson College. In addition, he's a traditionally trained Muslim scholar. He studied in various locations in the Muslim world, including at Al-Azhar in Cairo and Saudi Arabia. Further, he's the secretary of the Muslim Academic Trust, and he's the translator of a number of works, including two volumes from Al-Ghazali's Ihya Ulum al-Din. He's here with us this evening to talk about Jesus and Islam. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Tim Winter.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Thank you very much, Shazan. My children have done something terrible to my watch, so it's possible that I'll speak apparently without end. So if I'm going on too long, please don't hesitate to gesticulate. Also, since this is under the auspices of the chapel here, and since Muslims believe very strongly in the principle of, as we put it, bidhikrihim tanzilu rahma, by mentioning them, mercy descends. Whenever the name of a perfected human being is mentioned on this earth, a particular kind of stillness and divine favor results. So what I'd like to do is to begin with just a few seconds of silence, in which perhaps we can all focus on a particular aspect of the perfection of Jesus of Nazareth, just so that we begin, inshallah, on a blessed note. Well, that was the peaceful bit. I'm now going to get conflictual, I suppose, by calling to mind the first principle, which I'm going to wrestle with this evening. I gather that you're a mixed congregation of people from different faculties, and some have theological training and others don't. So I'm going to try and avoid technicalities and just talk you through, or walk you through, in hopefully a fairly intelligible way, a set of texts, so that in this probably unfamiliar topic we have some coordinates and texts that we can contemplate, to give us a sense of which way we're going. And the issue I'd like to raise at the beginning is the way in which the Islam-Christian relation has historically been figured in Western civilization as a particular instantiation of a polarity that was, until very recently, thought to explain just about everything significant in the differences between the major world religions. And that is that we used to think in terms of categories such as the Semitic and the Aryan. Certainly many of our professors in Cambridge in the 1940s were very happy with categories such as that. The idea being that human society is simply an extension of human biology, and human biology is dominated, if I can in Oxford invoke the phrase, by the selfish gene. And that therefore the understanding of the specifics of the religious life of particular sections of humanity must ultimately depend on an understanding of human biology. And so really living memory, Islam, and by extension its Christology, was subsumed under the large category of Semitic religion. The Arabs spoke a Semitic language, along with the Jews, the Ethiopians, and a few others, and it was thought that that meant certain inexorable things about what sort of religion they had to have. And one of the recurrent features of Western accounts of Islam is that many of the categories which are traditionally applied to Western understandings of Jewish religion are, as it were, imported into the understanding of Islam. Judaism and Islam, being Semitic, are law-bound, legalistic. They have a very transcendentalized idea of an inaccessible God, which is why they spend so much time on law. They tend to be terribly involved with issues of purity and ritual. They tend to be very obsessive about the boundary between right religion and other people. And another set of boxes are ticked whenever we think of the traditional images of the Semitic. In fact, Kenneth Cragg has recently published a book on Semitism, in which he explains this particular affinity between Islam and Judaism and Christianity as a thing apart. And that thing apart was thought to be from the Hellenic, Greco-Hellenic world through St. Paul, John's Gospel, the subsequent European and Europeanized Hellenistic Near Eastern reception of Jesus' message, and therefore we have a chain of thinking that leads up, I suppose, to the current Pope, who likes to think of Christianity as having a special relationship with Europe, because Europe has a special relationship with reason. These are very enduring categories. Take a look at the first of my handouts, and you'll see how this particular perception actually manifested itself, essentially, in a political agenda. Ernest Renan, of course, author of the first scientific or pseudo-scientific biography of Jesus, very interested in this traditional classification of Islam as Semitic. This is what he says. At the present time, the essential precondition for the spread of European civilization is the destruction of the Semitic thing par excellence, the destruction of Islam. Islam is the most complete negation of Europe. Islam is fanaticism. The future SERS is therefore Europe's and Europe's alone. Here is eternal war, the war which will end only when the last sons of Ishmael dies in misery or is banished through terror to the depths of the desert. And this kind of perception is very persistent, and you'll find this kind of rhetoric in a lot of modern evangelical explanations of the necessity of the war on terror. The missionaries riding on the tanks into Baghdad, this rhetoric, not in this country amongst evangelicals, but in the Bible Belt in America, is very much the norm rather than the exception. And then my second text, it shows the persistence of this. This is a bang-up-to-date text by a leading European expert, he's from Finland, in Muslim-Christian relations. And this is his understanding of how Muslims get to know God. Revelation in Islam is basically a legal code through which God legislates over all human affairs. Islam demands, above all, obedience and religious action, not theological analysis. Again, a very persistent perception, but one that neglects, for instance, the curriculum of just about any classical Islamic college or madrasa, where law is one of the things that you study, and a significant thing that you study, but is frequently regarded as being subordinate to the science of theology. and also in mystical circles, which historically have been very salient in Islamic civilization, subordinate to the science of the direct knowledge of God. But nonetheless, this idea of Islam as a kind of Judaic legalism is very, very persistent to this day. And very often, Western treatments of the Muslim understanding of Jesus have assumed that that's what's going on. There is the Aryan Christ, and there is the Semitic Judaic principle, which simply can't understand higher truths such as the union of God and man in a single entity. That's by way of a prologue. Let's now look at some of the original Islamic texts themselves, and the next few gobits are all from the Quran. Now, to understand these, many of you I know have already looked at them, but for those of you who are coming to them tabula rasa, it's helpful to bear in mind what the Quran takes itself to be, because sometimes it's regarded as the Bible of the Muslims, but it isn't really. It isn't a linear narrative that starts with the creation of the world and ends with the eschatological vengeance of God that we find in the book of Revelation. It's not chronological. Neither is it thematic. It's not a book of doctrine, certainly not a book of law. Law occupies a rather small total of the proportion of the Quranic text. It has stories of earlier prophetic episodes, some of which look strangely like their biblical equivalents, some of which are curiously different. But essentially what it is a large psalm-like hymn of glorification of God that is to be used liturgically. It doesn't take itself to be a theological book, doesn't take itself to be a law book, certainly doesn't take itself to be a history book. It is essentially experienced as a lectionary, a quarry of liturgical readings from which Muslims will draw material for worship. And theology and law and the other Islamic disciplines, of course, have to find their proof texts in the revelation itself. But that's not the principal way in which the text was received by the first generation of Muslim listeners or to this day. The Quran emerges, of course, in the 6th, the 7th century, and takes itself to be, in the true prophetic spirit, a polemic. In the first instance, it's a polemic against the indigenous religion of the Arabs, which is paganism. The Arabs are divided into dozens of different tribes, each of which has its own fetish or deity, and a shaman or soothsayer who connects the tribe to that deity and foresees the future, predicts propitious times for weddings, battles, and so forth. Islam is proposing a rather strange thing in the history of world religions. Whereas in the context, say, of the rise of Buddhism, what we are seeing is a corrective to what is already present. Buddhism is a continuation of what is indigenously Indian. What we are seeing with Christianity is something that clearly is, in a complex way, in continuity with certain fundamental assumptions of the Judaic matrix in which it first originated. Islam is different in that it is more combative in its initial setting. It doesn't seek to correct the beliefs and practices of its initial audience. It overthrows them entirely. It doesn't say, I am correcting Jewish religion by referring back to Jewish antecedents. It says, basically, what you people believe in, your form of worship, your collective memory, your anticipation of the human return after death, is all categorically mistaken. So the real polemic of the Quranic text is against the self. It's the Arab voice against the self. Arabian religion is being overthrown. In favor of what? Not in favor of the detailed revelation of a neighboring people. This is not a Christian missionary arguing with the pagan Arabs, nor is it a Jewish missionary, because there were many people converting to Judaism at that time. Instead, it's something different and unusual. It comes in Arabic. It's speaking to an initially Arabian audience, but it's overthrowing the indigenous values and practices of the Arabs, not in favor of neighboring successful religions, but in favor of something new that nonetheless claims a complex relationship to those neighboring religions. It is Abrahamic, it is monotheistic, and it endlessly claims to be that. So essentially what we're looking at with the Quranic revelation is a voice, as Muslims believe, the voice of God, turning the Arabian world on its head for the sake of the generic monotheism of the rival peoples to the Arabs. And basically Arabia in this time is a pagan island surrounded by what we call higher religions on all sides. But not asking them to trade up to the detailed specifics of Judaism or Christianity or Zoroastrianism. So it's unusual in the in terms of the general pattern of the origins of world religions in its radicalism. That's why Hans Kuhn says Christians ought to acknowledge Muhammad as a genuine prophet because of the intensely prophetic nature of his mission. Muhammad is discontinuity in person, he says. This is characteristically prophetic. If you accept the criteria for prophecy in the Old Testament, you can't then say that they don't apply to the Prophet Muhammad. So, primarily, the target of the Quran's polemic is the self, the Arabian self. But it is not uncritically affirmative of the stories of neighbors. It says, Judaism, Christianity, founded by authentic, true, perfect messengers of God. Moses was the spokesman of God. Abraham was the friend of God. Noah was saved by God. Adam was Adam. Jesus was the Messiah. But it says, but, it adds footnotes, which it takes to be, in every case, a restoration of the original messages of those interventions. That's, I think, it's fair to say, part of the originality. Religionists don't have to valorize originality as such, but we can say as historians, part of the originality of the message is this idea that one has to get back to a kind of primordial sort of religion that humanity recurrently falls away from. And that's the key to understanding the interesting things that the Quran has to say about Christians and Christianity. The original message was absolutely correct and saved people, and we have no argument with that, but subsequently there were accretions. It's almost, you could describe it as a Reformation moment. Perhaps if you wanted to use Western categories, you could say Islam is like the first thing that looks like a reformation of Christianity, but it's so radical that it ends up as a different religion. But the first Christians who saw Islam, of course, didn't think it was a new religion. St. John of Damascus and other people at the Umayyad court in Syria said, this is a Christian heresy. It's got something to do with the Arians, and it's very Judaic. But it's not a new religion. This is a type of Christianity. So perhaps Reformation is a context for all of this. Now, the Quran famously affirms individual members of the earlier scriptural traditions. And this 3a here from Surah 2 of the Quran is actually a verse that occurs three times in the Quran. It seems to uncritically affirm all of these traditions, those who believe, by which it means Muslims, those who are Jews, and the Christians, and the Sabians, who are a small category we don't need to spend time on. Whoever believes in God and the last day and acts uprightly, they have their reward from their Lord. Apparently an open and shut case. This is a kind of modern, pluralistic, inclusive affirmation of the religious value of the other. That's what it seems to be saying. And there are many other affirmations in the Quran and the Hadith that seem to be saying the same unqualified thing. And there is to be a specific positive relationship with Christians, which is also unambiguous in the Quran. So the next one. You will certainly find the closest in love to the believers to be those who say, we are Christians. That is because among them are priests and monks, and because they are not proud. It's another example of this philo-Christian dimension in the Quran. So far, so good. There's an affirmation, and the Quran certainly doesn't have anything positive to say about Arabian paganism. But then it becomes more complex. Look at 3c. We gave Jesus the gospel. Christians will immediately wonder exactly what that means. And in the hearts of his followers set kindness, that should be, and mercy. And monasticism, that they invented, we did not prescribe it for them. They were only desiring to please God, but they did not worship it aright. Here, obviously, there is the beginning of a critique. Incidentally, it would be very helpful if modern form criticism could help us to date these passages chronologically. We might begin to see the unfolding of a Quranic story about Christianity, but in fact, given the state of our knowledge, we can't give a reliable chronology for these texts. There's a lot of guesswork out there, but nothing that's generally accepted by scholars. But look at this thing. We gave Jesus the gospel. That immediately is affirming Jesus, but in a recognizably Islamic conception of what a messenger of God is. The best messengers of God are those who receive scriptures. Part of the perfection of their message is that they give people a book. Moses had the Torah, David had the Psalms, Jesus had the Gospel, Muhammad has the Quran. They're all part of the same pattern of divine intervention in the world. Whereas from a Christian perspective, this seems an odd way of looking at it. The Gospels, of course, come subsequently because the authors of the Gospels, however you date them, obviously are writing after the crucifixion. And then this apparent criticism of the monastic tradition says that they had the right sort of intention. They were only desiring to please God, but they did not worship it aright, or they did not observe it aright. And that eventually develops into a Muslim polemic against ideas of celibacy, which Islam doesn't accept as a valid part of the process of mortification. And then 3D, another critique. With those who say we are Christians, we made a covenant, but they forgot a part of the admonition. So we stirred up discord and aversion among them until the day of resurrection. That becomes more pungent. And this is clearly an echo of what was generally known to be the case in Arabia at the time, which was that Christianity was a lot of contesting sects, particularly in the Middle East. People were aware of the Nestorians, who had bishops in places like Bahrain and the Yemen. They were aware of Monophysites of various types, of the Jacobites, the Copts, and the Great Church in Byzantium, as well as other smaller groups, which we might speak about later on. And the intense passions, usually over Christological issues between those sects, were clearly in the air in Western Arabia in the 7th century. Now we get into specifically the narratives about Jesus, and this is where the abilities of historians are stretched to and usually beyond the limit. Because what happens here is that in the Quran's infancy narratives, in its retelling of the story of the birth of Jesus and the conception of Jesus, you find the fundamental points of difference between Islamic and normative Christian Christology. It's all cast in terms of a rewriting of familiar gospel accounts. Some of you, some Muslims anyway, might have seen the recent Iranian film about the life of the Virgin Mary, which takes the Quranic account to mean that Mary had been dedicated as a temple virgin, serving in the temple in Jerusalem, and that it was at that point that that her miracles began, the first of which is narrated in this passage from Surah 3. Her Lord accepted her graciously and made her grow in grace. Zechariah took charge of her. Whenever Zechariah entered the sanctuary to her, he found provisions beside her. And according to the classical commentaries, and it's done in the film using various special effects, she would have miraculous fruit that was given to her to sustain her through her night vigils and devotions. The fruit of summer would come in winter, the fruit of winter in summer, which was a sign Zechariah saw of her special status. O Mary, how have you found this? She replied, it is from God. God provides without reckoning for whomsoever he will. The classic statement of the saint, whenever a miracle is attributed to the saint, is to say, it's not from me, it's from God. So this narrative is constructed to indicate that she is indeed a true saint and is to be. She does actually become a kind of proof text for later Muslim theological discussions of whether people other than prophets can have miracles. Prophets can have miracles that are technically described as mu'jiza, apologetic miracles in Islamic theology. But saints, purified human beings, can also have supernatural events happening to them, which are referred to as karamat. And since Mary is generally not regarded as being a prophet, but is clearly a saintly woman, siddiqa, the fact that she's receiving these miracles becomes, for subsequent Muslim theology, a strong argument to indicate that the saints too, even though they're not prophets, can work miracles. And then you have, in another part of the Quran, Surah 19, which is actually named after the Virgin Mary, Surah Maryam, the story of the Annunciation, which is done in a very interesting, elegant, syncopated, rhymed kind of Arabic, which a translation can't really do justice to. mention in the book Mary when she withdrew from her people to an easterly place. She took before them a veil, then we sent to her our spirit, who appeared to her as a man without fault. She said, I take refuge with the merciful from you, if you fear God. He said, I am only the messenger of your Lord to give you a pure son. She said, how may I have a son when no man has touched me and I was not unchaste? He said, thus shall it be. Your Lord said, it is easy for me that we may make him a sign for the people and a mercy from us. It is a thing decreed. And that's your annunciation. And again, in the film, it's done quite dramatically. Then the story becomes curious, at least to readers of the usual infancy gospels. And the birth pangs drove her to the trunk of a tree, palm tree specifically, Jidain Nakhla. She said, would that I had died before this and had been a thing forgetting, forgotten. Then he called to her, it's not quite clear who, but probably an angel, from below her, grieve not, your Lord has set before you a stream. Shake towards you the trunk of the palm, and it will drop moist, ripe dates upon you. Now, we're obviously in new territory here. There's none of the familiar narrative of the stable, the wise men, the shepherds, Joseph. She's on her own. She's out in the desert, somewhere to the east of Jerusalem, because she's a temple virgin who got pregnant, so she's run away for fear of everybody's accusations. And incidentally, this is a text that is frequently used by modern Muslim feminists where they want to affirm the autonomous validity of the saintly woman. The Virgin Mary in Islam is not dependent upon helpful males nearby. She does her most significant things on her own. The patriarchy, the priests at the temple have driven her out because she's pregnant. She's all on her own. She's a single mother. And she takes refuge beneath the trunk of a palm tree, and then the labor pains come to her. And then another miracle, the stream. And then, and this is regarded by the commentators as a particularly nice touch, she's just given birth, she's exhausted, she's asked to grab the palm tree and shake it so that the dates come down. Such is her trusting submission to God that she immediately does that without any hesitation. And of course, the dates fall and she is nourished. Now, at this point, we need to take a step back and think about tedious academic things like sources. I mentioned earlier that it is very difficult to come up with a linear connection between the Quran's Christology and what these secular historians would regard as its natural context or antecedents. In this case, those of you who have looked at the non-canonical infancy gospels, the Protevangelium of James, for instance, will actually recognize this. There is the tree, and there are the dates, and she's on her own. And there are a number of other accounts in the Muslim infancy narratives about the birth of Jesus, which are not there in the four canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but are actually there in some early Christian apocryphal literature. The exact nature of the relationship would be very tempting to establish, but unfortunately nobody's been able to prove how such a communication could have taken place. But certainly the texts are there. And if you look at these various books that come from the US called The Complete Gospels, 600 pages, and you've got all of the little fragments as well as the established gospels and ones that were discovered at Nag Hammadi and elsewhere, you will find this. If you look at the Protevangelium of James, it parallels the Quranic account. Now, what happens next in the Quranic story, and I haven't typed out all of it here, is that she is asked to go back to Jerusalem with the baby to face the music. And just to make things even more difficult for her, she is asked to swear that she will not speak for 3 days, which is taken to be a kind of fast. So she has to go back with the baby, but she can't explain even this far-fetched story. And again, modern Muslim feminists who like to use this text as a kind of prototype or an ideal type will focus on that. She's autonomous, she's on her own, she's going back to face the critique of the patriarchs, but God vindicates her. She's right and they're wrong. And again, if you've seen the film, and that's where her life really ends in the film, she comes back to Jerusalem, she's holding the baby, and the priests and everybody ask her, Mary, how did this happen? You are not from a family of harlots. Sha'arat ilay, and she kind of points to the baby, as if to indicate that the baby is going to explain it all. And of course, even greater incredulity. And they say, كيف نكلم من كان في المهدي صبية? How can we speak to somebody who's just a baby in a crib? And then the baby Jesus speaks. And this is what he says. Jesus' first miracle, he said, I am God's servant. He has given me the book and made me a prophet. He has made me blessed wherever I may be. And his little sermon goes on. Again, that's certainly not biblical. But it has a certain symmetry. And certainly it's taken by Muslims as being his first miracle, his neonatal, but already his preaching a sermon. And most critically, what's the first thing that he says? Inni Abdullah, I'm the servant of God. In other words, it's a Christological statement that he wants to begin with. This is the relationship between him and his creator. He is not equal with God. He is not part of God. He is not fused with God. He is not fully man and fully God. Inni Abdullah, I'm the slave of God. So this is a very carefully constructed narrative which inserts Jesus in the Muslim set of assumptions about how God deals with human beings. So he's God's servant, and then, like a proper prophet, he's got a book, and he's a prophet, and he's a holy man. May blessed wherever I may be, the wandering holy man of his time and place. Then the Quran pays not much attention to him, although there are some miracles that are attributed to him. The famous miracle that the Quran mentions is when Jesus, as well as bringing life to the dead and healing the leper and the blind, he can bring life to something inanimate. He takes a piece of clay, molds it into a bird, breathes upon the bird, and the bird becomes a live bird and flies away. Again, it's not in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but it's in the Gospel of Thomas, one of these Gnostic Gospels that were dug up in Egypt, Nag Hammadi, about 50 years ago. Again, establishing the connection is beyond our power, but at least we know that it hasn't come from thin air. Most interesting stuff is going to come at the end, and here many people have found the Quranic narrative rather frustrating, because all you get about the crucially important end point of Jesus' earthly ministry is this one verse. They did not kill him, this is referring to the Jews, and they did not crucify him, but it was made to seem so to them. Those who differ about him, remember the Quran's earlier point about Christological argument, those who differ about him are in doubt concerning him. They have no knowledge about him, but follow opinion. Certainly they did not kill him, but God raised him to himself. And that's all you get. Nothing in the hadith that expands upon that. No other mention in the Quran, which often likes to return to prophetic stories again and again. That's all you get in the founding scriptures of the religion. So what do we have here? Well, the commentators say the thing that is clear is that the Jews did not kill him. That's explicit. The Jews are exonerated. It must have been the Romans if he was killed or crucified. Does it mean that he wasn't killed or crucified at all? Well, it was made to seem so to them. Does that really imply that there was no crucifixion? Most Muslim commentators historically have said yes, that somehow he was delivered. God raised him to himself instead. God does not allow his messengers to be humiliated. God will save them in the nick of time. And so you have a whole outpouring of Muslim speculations down the ages, some of which will say, for instance, well, it was Judas Iscariot who God transfigured to make him look like Jesus at the last moment, and protesting his innocence, he was crucified in Jesus' stead while Jesus made good his escape. Other people will say Jesus just ascended to heaven and there was no crucifixion at all. A lot of Muslim commentators, however, especially nowadays, looking at this text, will say you haven't really got an unambiguous denial of the fact of the crucifixion. what you have got is an exoneration of the Jews. What you have got is an affirmation of the ascension of some kind, which is necessary because Islam believes that Jesus will return again at the end of time. What you haven't got 100% is what scholars call dalil qat'i, a decisive proof text to show that the crucifixion didn't take place. Incidentally, I was living in Turkey 3 or 4 years ago, and the Da Vinci Code was an absolute bestseller there. And you can see how the kind of conspiracy theory of Jesus was actually drugged because there was opium in the wine that he was given on the cross and he was taken down and then secretly resuscitated kind of fits in with at least some of this Muslim speculation. That's the Quranic Jesus. And then you get comments on the subsequent evolution of Christology in the Christian churches. And this is phrased in condemnation, reproach. And ghulu is the term that the Quran uses, which means going to excess, going beyond the bounds. Now, people of the book, in this case Christians, be not extreme, ghulu in your religion. Speak of God only the truth. The Messiah, son of Mary, is only the messenger of God, and his word which he placed in Mary and a spirit from him. So believe in God and in his messengers, and do not say three. Cease, it is better for you. God is only one God. Far exalted is he above having a son. Clearly there's more going on in this passage. Jesus' messianic status, of course, is affirmed. Messenger of God, his word, which he placed in Mary, not a logos doctrine at all, but interpreted in terms of the divine command. Word, kun, be and he is. God spoke that word to Jesus and created him. God's creative word brought him into being. And he placed him in Mary and a spirit from him, ruhun minhu. In other words, something that is to do with the communication of the holiness of God, not the essence of God, not the nature of God, but the holiness and the qualities of God which are represented in a saintly human being. So believe in God and in his messengers, and do not say three. Cease, it is better for you. Probably, although academics nowadays like to argue about just about everything, and they are contesting this, but probably this is a reference to the doctrine of the Trinity. It's hard to see exactly how that could refer to anything else, which is unanimously understood in Muslim commentaries as referring to Father, Son, Holy Ghost. God is only one God. Far exalted is he above having a son. Son here understood in the sense of a filiation, the divine essence actually proceeding into a distinct entity, which for Muslims just can't exist. Okay, that's the Quranic text that I wanted to share with you. Let me now explore some of the more recent speculations about where this comes from, where it's taking us, and close with some thoughts about whether this is actually good news or bad news for what is certainly the important enterprise of Muslim-Christian dialogue and rapprochement. Text number 5, and this is something from Oxford, which I pulled out. This is from the Bampton Lectures. The beginning of Western study of the Quran and its apparent literary matrix. Oxford was one of the first places where this was done. Oxford had Britain's first professorship of Arabic, the Laudian professorship, which of course is still alive and thriving. If the Quran sometimes surprises us with unusual grandeur and magnificently paints the Almighty sitting upon the eternal throne, encompassed with clouds and darkness and giving laws to the universe, we instantly recognize the hallowed manner, the ideas, and even the language of the Hebrew prophets. But its source lies in the wild and fanciful opinions of the ancient Arabs, and chiefly in those exhaustless stores of marvelous and improbable fiction, the works of the rabbins. In other words, it's midrashic. That's where we need to look in order to complete our picture of where these Quranic stories come from, particularly the stories that seem to have Old Testament parallels. You want to know exactly why the story of Moses and the burning bush is different? Look in the Talmud and the Midrashic and the Haggadic literature, which is beginning to be explored in the 18th century amongst non-Jewish scholars. If you want to understand the origins of the Jesus narrative, then you'll have to look at rather different apocryphal Christian stories. But certainly this is where our story as Western scholars begins. We look for the sources, we look for the literary matrix in which these stories made sense. And the biggest theory that has prevailed for some time, for at least 100 years, which has linked our study and our understanding of early Islam to the category of the Semitic, consists in our attempt to look over the very confused argumentative landscape of 6th, 7th century Middle Eastern Christianity, and to look to see where this particular vision of who Jesus was might have originated. What was its matrix? Why does the Quran adopt this particular Christology? Remember the remarks that I kicked off with, that the origins of Islam are curious in that they represent an Arabian voice against Arabian values in favor of the monotheistic principles of neighboring peoples, but not resulting in the introduction of the detailed religious practices of those peoples. What is going on in the Near East at that time that might allow us to account for the Quran's particular Christology? Not the Son of God, he's not divine, he's not one person in a trinity, but he is the Messiah with an eschatological role. He is the son of a virgin. He is a worker of miracles. He is sent to the people of Israel. And he's observant. He's practicing the Torah. Those are, if you like, the five basic things that the Muslim scriptures attribute to Jesus. Where does that come from? Well, the currently fashionable theory, and it's been speculated over for some decades now, but you could probably say that it's the most popular speculation at the moment, is that we need to look at those mysterious people called the Ebionites. Who are the Ebionites? Those of you who studied the New Testament will know that Jesus had a brother, James. Catholics aren't supposed to think that, but in any case, brother in some sense, who leads the church after Jesus' disappearance. And he leads the community as observant Jews in the temple. The Book of Acts acknowledges this. And then, following various ructions with the various authorities and the followers of Paul, they push off into the Arabian desert. And the Roman province of Arabia basically means roughly what we nowadays call Jordan. And they set up shop in cities such as Pella and other cities in northern and central Jordan. And when the Romans destroy the temple 10 years later, the last remnants of the original Judaically observant sort of Christianity are finally squashed and it becomes a pagan city. And the initiative passes to the hands of the Hellenized Christians, if you see things in those terms, basically Paul's communities in Asia Minor and further west. And the Jewish Christians get a very bad press. Eusebius doesn't like them at all. Byzantine writers such as Sozomen in the 6th century say, yes, they're still around and they still haven't got the point about Jesus, the Son of God, and they still think that they have to keep kosher and be circumcised. Irenaeus of Lyons also refers to them. Ignatius of Antioch. Many early Christian heresiographers say, these guys are still around. But we don't have text from the Jewish Christians themselves, from these Ebionim, these poor Christians. Presumably they had texts, but they haven't survived. But you can see where modern scholarship gets excited here, because it seems that you have the missing link. Islam seems to have Ebionite roots. So Hans-Joachim Schurz, 50 years ago, has this to say. There is no doubt, even though he's German, he goes so far as to say there is no doubt, about the indirect dependence of Muhammad on Jewish Christianity. The result of this is a paradox with a truly world historical dimension. While Jewish Christianity disappeared in the Christian church, by contrast it was preserved in Islam, where it has found a place to our day in some of its directing impulses. That's fairly strong stuff, and we'll see in a few minutes whether that needs qualifying or not. Here's another example. Even more dramatic, Schlatter, history of early Christianity. None of the leaders of the imperial church suspected that the day would come when this Christianity, which they despised, would shake the world and destroy a large part of the churches which they had built up. It came at the time when Muhammad took over the possession guarded by the Jewish Christians, their consciousness of God, their eschatology, which preached the day of judgment, their customs and legends, and established a new apostolate as the one sent by God. Again, Schlatter, a significant figure in history of early Christianity, is quite clear that this can't be a coincidence. The Ebionite Christology looks so similar to the Christology of the Quran that that must be the missing link. That's where the connection is to be sought. And more up to date, this is a slightly populist book. One of the besetting hazards of writing in New Testament studies is that if you write a popular book, you can immediately make $1 million. And I think that Professor Boots possibly succumbed to that temptation when entitling his book. But it's a good book. It is more than intriguing that the Muslim understanding of Jesus is very much in conformity with the first Christian orthodoxy, the original Jewish Christian understanding of Jesus. So, there's another one. Now, we need to think very carefully about whether this is going to work or not. Muslims are going to be hesitant, obviously, because the Quran is a revelation from God and isn't influenced by earlier literary traditions. So this isn't automatically the kind of argument that's going to commend itself to Muslims. In fact, it might seem a bit edgy. The existence of Jewish Christianity in the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th centuries in Western Arabia is, more seriously, a matter largely for speculation. And Hans Kung, in his new, he always writes books that are much too big, it's about that big, his new book on Islam has about, well, a couple of dozen pages on Jewish Christianity and looking for the evidence that suggested that it existed in that time and place. For Western Arabia, he can't really find anything, although he really wants to. But he finds all kinds of stuff in Iraq, a sect called the El-Khasayites, for instance, who are circumcised, who don't eat pork, who believe in Jesus as Messiah, but who continue to affirm a Judaic type of monotheism. Other groups, similarly, in Arabia, also a few in Egypt, there are these people knocking around, these Jewish Christians. Unfortunately, we don't have the text, we don't have the archaeology, it's speculative, but there is a certain amount of material there. But what Kung hasn't demonstrated, and I think nobody has demonstrated, is that there was a Jewish Christian synagogue in Mecca in the 7th century. If we could find something like that, if in the foundations of these horrible new hotels that they're building all over Mecca, they dig up the Hilton and look underneath to see if there's something Hebrew there, or Syriac or Aramaic, that would be a discovery of greater significance than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Because then you'd have the hermeneutic key to understanding the specific temper of a major world religion. The origins of Islam, despite the abundance of the Islamic sources, are still hotly contested by historians, largely because of the absence of contemporaneous or archaeological records. But we haven't found it. I sometimes tell my students that to know whether what I'm saying is rubbish or not, they have to wait until the Red Sea Scrolls are discovered, and then we'll have some kind of verification, because we'll have a contemporary set of external controls with which we can test these various theories. Anyway, Hans Kung and others have not hesitated to say this eureka moment, which they think we have reached. Islam's Christology is Ebionite, it's the original Jewish Christianity of Jerusalem, is going to be the unlocking of the key to a wonderful new world into religious faith, understanding and dialogue. So, Hans Kung, I suppose this is about two-thirds of the way through his book, page 501, I guess. Christians should no longer see the Quranic understanding of Jesus as Muslim heresy, but as a Christology with a primitive Christian colouring on Arabian soil. The inconvenient insight into the affinity of Jewish, Christian, and Quranic Christology will prove extremely fruitful. And he goes on to explain that because of his idea of a global ethic and particularly bringing about the sense of a common ground, a common discourse for the three Abrahamic monotheisms, which despite their similarities have often been daggers drawn. The way to do this is to point out the Jewishness of Jesus. He was Jewish, he worshipped as a Jew, his conception of God was Jewish, etc., etc., etc. If you can do that, this is his previous book on Judaism, then you can start healing the rift between Christianity and Judaism. But he said also, if you focus on that aspect of Jesus, then you start to heal the rift with Islam as well. Because this Muslim Jesus that seems to be such an aberration actually turns out to fit in quite well to what Kuhn takes to be the original Jewish outlook of Jesus of Nazareth. And then finally, this is another book with an extremely popularizing and unpromising title. It sounds more or less like the Da Vinci Code, but he is a professor of New Testament. The Christianity we know from the Q source, from the letter of James, from the Didac, and some of our other surviving Jewish Christian sources represents a version of the Jesus faith that can actually unite rather than divide Jews, Christians, and Muslims. If nothing else, the insights revealed through an understanding of the Jesus dynasty, that's part of his thesis, which I won't go into, can open wide, new, and fruitful doors of dialogue and understanding among these three great traditions that have in the past considered their views of Jesus to be so sharply contradictory as to close off discussion. It all sounds very exciting, perhaps unnerving to Muslims and perhaps puzzling to a lot of Christians, and the problem is that as I said, we don't have a missing link to establish Ebionite Christian presence in 7th century Western Arabia. And similarly, our understanding of exactly what the content was of Jewish Christianity in the 1st and 2nd century is very hotly contested, and there's been a lot of recent scholarship that has thrown all this into debate again, exactly who the Ebionites were. But in any case, that's the note on which I thought I'd close, that scholars can at least have the impulse to bring about a convergence and a conversation, even if the actuality proves difficult. Is somebody going to share questions? I believe we've got time for a discussion. Shazan, this is, seems to be your vocation this evening.
Okay, how long do you think?
I don't know. What time do they chuck us out? We've probably got it. Okay, good.
Questions?
I have a very basic question. I've always wondered about this. What makes Islam
Abrahamic faith? That's a good question, because it calls itself an Abrahamic faith, and because Abraham is a fundamental figure in the Quran's image of the development and perpetuation of monotheism. It's Abrahamic, but in a particular way, in that whereas Judaism and Christianity trace their authenticity through Isaac, Islam goes through Ishmael. So it's distinctive. It's through the older son who's rejected. And that means that even though it's very proud of its Abrahamic legitimacy, it has a particular sense of itself as the Gentile and the outcast, because Ishmael is half African, half Egyptian. Hagar is the kind of external person who comes in to help Abraham with his kind of surrogate motherhood program. And therefore, that lineage is figured, according to the conceptions of the book of Genesis, as the ger, the alien, the foreigner, half Egyptian, half African, therefore not the heirs to the promise. And the Islamic understanding is that God is precisely with the rejected and the outcast. Hagar and Ishmael are ejected into the desert, but God eventually will vindicate them, which is the story of the building of the Kaaba and hence the rise of Islam as the sort of Ishmaelite unexpected coda to the end of Abrahamic history. The term Abrahamic is generally used in the interfaith industry to refer to the three monotheisms. I think it's generally quite widely used. I know that Rowan Williams uses it. Do you see ways in which it might be problematic?
I just wonder because, I mean, I guess because part of me, I don't know a lot about Islam, the origin of Islam, or the origin of Arabic people, I suppose. That's historically and also a question, isn't it, as well? So, tracing the root back to Ishmael, and it, I mean, perhaps it has a mythical truth. in a biblical scriptural sense, but how historically and
archaeologically? Historically and archaeologically, Abraham is a mythological figure. The British Museum 10 years ago had an exhibition on Abraham. And there was, as far as I could see, they were wasting their time. They didn't have anything. They just talked about how different traditions had invented the story of Abraham. But there's no archaeology or original text of any kind. Yeah. Yeah.
And apparently from your presentation, there is a conflicting situation between Jewish beliefs and Muslim ones, okay? And usually in the academic world, there is a purpose of trying to raise an issue, a question, trying to address it and solve it, okay? So if there is a conflicting situation between these two, what is the solution for the problem? It's not up to me to say there is a real problem, okay, on the ground. But if there is a problem, what's the applicability in the real life?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the academic argument for that as well?
Well, the problem between Islam and Judaism is less acute than the problem between any other two world religions. Jakob Neusner says they're the two closest religions, and he's written, I don't know how many books, but one of his books is a comparison between Jewish law and Islamic law, and he says these are two religions that are closer than any other religions are. And I think that's probably fair if you look at the theology, the historical interactions, the idea of law, the way in which law is administered. It's undeniable. The two traditions are at some distance from Christianity, however. And that's where this old category of the Semitic tends to link Islam and Judaism very closely together, and Christianity as being the Hellenistic idea that God has a son and the son dies and rises again, which Jewish polemic against Christianity and Muslim polemic against Christianity regard as being incompatible with their idea of monotheism. But was your question about how there can be a contemporary rapprochement?
Well, if there is a real diverging, let's say, conflicting situation between these two ideologies, and if there is a problem, what's the solution to that?
And I don't think there is a significant difference, but then the reality is that even slightly different versions of a single religion can hate each other. And that's just, the sibling rivalries can be some of the most intense. The fact that you're theologically and ritually close to another religion doesn't mean that you're going to get on with them, unfortunately. The current difficulties that everybody is preoccupied by in the Middle East are to do with various forms of nationalism that have used aspects of religion to justify themselves, but are essentially contests over land and national rights, rather than being rooted in specific religious differences.
Could you say something? You've spoken of the historical context of Ebionites in Arabia. Could you say something of the historical context of Judaism itself?
Right.
Clearly, the two religions you said are very close, because the pagan context is very different.
Yep.
One's tempted to think it was in those very much in Judaism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're pretty sure that there were no settled Jewish communities in Mecca at the time of the rise of Islam, but we know that there were very substantial settlements of Jews in oasis cities elsewhere in the peninsula, and indeed there was a Jewish state to the south of Mecca in the Yemen, Dhu Nu'as, Joseph seems to have been his name. The oasis cities in the north, Khaybar, Taymat, Dumat al-Jandal, Wadi al-Qura, all of those places, which are kind of the boundary of Arabia with southern Iraq, had very substantial Jewish settlements. And many scholars would say that actually these are Arab converts to Judaism, rather than people who have come as part of the diaspora process. Clearly, that was in the air at the time that the early Islamic narratives were engaging with the populations. And the Arabs, as a largely pre-literate oral community, would have been great exchanges of poetry and stories, and certainly would have been aware of the major prophetic stories of the Old Testament, and also of a lot of the extra-canonical, Haggadic, legendary ornamentation that was in the air as well. So, yeah, Judaism is an important, very important constituency in the original period of the religion. What you can't do definitively is prove linear influence. But nonetheless, it's also difficult to point to any given feature of the new religion and say that's completely original.
Professor Winter, thank you for your talk. Two brief questions I had for you. In discussing the possibility of a rapprochement or a dialogue between Islam and Christianity, so you mentioned that some of the similarities between a Christian Christography and an Islamic Christography can be related to the Gnostic Gospels or other Gospel-like accounts that have surfaced within the last couple centuries of archaeology. My first question was, if the authenticity of those Christographies could be discredited from a historiological standpoint when compared to the canonical Gospels, would that then cast some doubt on the authenticity of the Islamic account of Christ? I'm not making any assumptions one way or the other. I'm just asking you what you thought about that. And then as far as an Ebionitic Christology, that's also not something I'm very schooled in at all, but from what little I understood, the Ebionites accepted the sonship and deity of Christ, but insisted on maintaining traditional Jewish practices, such as the ones you mentioned, dietary restrictions, mm-hmm. practices of circumcision, etc. So I'm wondering, is there any compelling evidence to suggest an alternative Ebionite Christology?
Well, I'm very far from being a New Testament or patristics expert. I just look at this from the perspective of what's now coming into my own field of Islamic studies. The impression I get, however, is that the field is wide open and that there are some people who believe that there were many Jewish Christians who didn't accept the conciliar formulations about the status of Christ and others who did. And since we don't have any literature to speak of from the communities themselves, it's probably always going to be a matter of guesswork. As to whether, if you could demonstrate the inauthenticity of that material, that would impact upon the validity of the Quran's Christology, it probably wouldn't for Muslims themselves, because Muslims have never been aware of or particularly interested in a Jewish Christian antecedent to their story. If anything, it kind of makes it look like a naturalistic issue of influence rather than a new revelation. But it's also the case that one would need to know how one could demonstrate that an extra-canonical gospel was not factual and a canonical gospel was factual, because the canonical gospels themselves are the subject of endless arguments. There's apparently a new scholarly book published on the New Testament every 20 minutes now. And every possible theory or speculation has been explored and has been for 100 years. But there is an increasing reluctance in the field, I think, to recognize the existence of a kind of Berlin Wall between the Gospels that the Church, whenever it was the Council of Carthage, decided would be the Bible, and other documents that were also very early that describe aspects of the life of Jesus that have to be repudiated altogether. And a lot of theologians nowadays, as well as New Testament scholars, would say there's much value in this allegedly extra-canonical material. But as I say, I'm not an expert.
Could you share, what is the official view of Islam to the Holy Bible? Just thinking on what you shared about Mary and Jesus not dying, mm-hmm. and I guess this might be a tough one as well, and the official view, if actually someone converted from the view of Islam to how Christians would see the truth of the Bible. What's the official view there? Because you hear so many...
There isn't one, because there's no officialdom. It's a non-hierarchical religion. You can speak very often of a consensus, but there's no sort of organization of hierarchy that leads up to a bishop or a pope that defines what's right and wrong. In terms of the consensual view that Muslims have of the Bible, most Muslims are not terribly interested in the subject, I regret to say. Generally, the view is that this is an accumulation of stories, many of which may have an important kernel of truth, but which lack rigorous authentication and whose authorship is unknown. And on vitally important questions of truth and salvation, you have to have a scripture that's more rigorously authenticated. So the Bible is like a set of old legends that can perhaps be read for personal upliftment, but can't be regarded as a reliable statement of fact. And of course, there are Anglican vicars I know who take essentially the same view. It's not a specifically Muslim point of view. I think it was Daily Telegraph survey recently said that a third of Church of England vicars don't believe in the literal truth of the virgin birth, for instance. So the boundaries are not absolute. I'm not really talking about issues of Islamic law this evening. The apostasy issue is something that's contested, and there are different points of view in Islam, as historically there have been in Christianity. But it's worth recollecting that all pre-modern societies took a dim view of converting out. Archbishop Lord, who created the post in Arabic in this university, also instituted a kind of inquisitorial process for English people who converted to Islam at the time. And the standard punishment was that they were impaled on stakes. And there are a number of cases of British people who were found to have converted to Islam, and the Church of England had them impaled on stakes. It took about a week to die. So that's pre-modern humanity, unfortunately. Who's next?
Put aside a literal interpretation of Jesus as the Son of God that Daniel did, then is there a parallel, or what's the closest that we can see in the Islamic tradition of how the Christians view Jesus?
You mean, is there a Muslim interpretation of Jesus that might come quite close to some Christian interpretations?
No, I mean, taking aside the fact that there's the irreconcilable difference in that, mm-hmm. if they believe in the actual Son of God, Muslims obviously don't believe in that.
Yeah.
But in terms of how they view Jesus, what they believe about him, other than that, and the kind of role he has in Christianity, what's the parallels of that in Islam?
Well, I suppose the most salient in most believers' imagination is the eschatological role that he's going to return at the end of time. And I was in Damascus last summer, and the imam of the mosque very proudly pointed out the minaret of the mosque, which is the Jesus minaret, which is where he's going to descend at the end of time. And surprise everybody, I guess. There's a grave dug for him already in Medina next to the prophet. The grave is ready and waiting for him. The exact imagining of that is somewhat different in that the book of Revelation is an extremely kind of, it's about the violent settling of accounts. It's about God as rigor, justice. Jesus has the rod of iron, the eyes of fire, the feet of brass, and he's terrifying. And he casts the sinners into eternal torment. That's a text that's very important for a lot of American political evangelicals at the moment. For the mainstream Church of England, it's kind of not used very much or treated as a metaphor for the triumph of the church generally. Islam's image of Jesus at the end of time also indicates that there will be a conflict, a kind of Armageddon-like conflict in which he is present, but the kind of rigor of the treatment is much less. America's best-selling non-fiction author at the moment is somebody called Hal Lindsey, who's an American evangelical preacher. And he recently published a book called Blood Moon, which is a novel, which is basically about the end times. And one of the things that he predicts happening is that the Palestinians will come perilously close to establishing a state of their own. And Jesus will appear in order to stop that. The Palestinians will be marching on Jerusalem, and Jesus appears, and death rays emerge from his eyes, and the Palestinians' brains burn, and they boil, and they die, and then everybody lives happily ever after. You can't get the book in this country, but in America it's popular. I had to order it from Amazon USA. For millions of Americans, that part of the Bible is really important. For Muslims, there's a kind of general sense that the end of time will be associated with the second coming of Jesus, but it's much less central to Muslim imagination, I think, for various reasons. The reason why it has to be Jesus, of course, is the evident one that he is the only one that the Christians, who are taken to be the ones who will really be messing up in the end time, will listen to. If Muhammad comes back and says to George Bush, "You've misunderstood everything," he won't pay so much attention as if Jesus turns up and wags his finger at him and says, "Actually, Christianity is, or religion is something else." That's why it has to be Jesus rather than another prophet.
Could I just, sorry to interject, there is an actual scripture, and the prophet Zechariah said in Zechariah 14, first four verses, exactly that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where Hal Lindsey takes, it's not just out of the sky, it's the prophet saying that Israel will be surrounded and then the Lord will come.
Yeah.
Zechariah 14.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know that. But I'm sure that most Christians around the world wouldn't associate that particularly with the destruction of a Palestinian army. I think that's something that comes from his own imagination.
All nations.
All nations. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
How is it, as long as the shepherd, how is it that Muslims and Christians can reconcile the very essentially, so we as Muslims accept that Jesus and Muhammad essentially, peace be upon them both, brought down a message of monotheism. However, the way in which they both lived their lives, Jesus as the embodiment of a rejection of worldly attractions and desires, Muhammad, peace be upon them as well, living his life in a very different way in terms of reconciling the existence of the human self and the desires, and also the desire to know God and elevate oneself spiritually. How is it that Christians and Muslims can reconcile these two very different characters that were embodied within these two characters, even though they both carry from a Muslim perspective?
Well, the prophets each speak with their own language to their own people. The Muslim understanding would be that Moses was sent with a law to a people who needed a law, that Jesus was sent to a people who already had a law, who had lost sight of certain ascetical and spiritual principles, and so his teaching focused on that. And the final prophet brings both, because his people haven't got anything at all. They haven't got a law, they're just a bunch of feuding tribes, and they haven't got anything by way of a spiritual life. So he represents a kind of complete restitution. In terms of how you create a dialogue, a lot of people are working on this at the moment. And the focus tends to be on the fact that Christians and Muslims have, at least in their medieval theologies, defined human perfection as reflecting qualities that are present in God. How do I know it's good to be just? Because God is just. How do I know it's good to be loving and merciful? Because God is loving and merciful. And that being made in the image of God is fundamental to Christian ideas, what it is to be a saint, to be godly. And you have the same thing in Islam, where the idea of being created in the image of God, خَلَقَ آدَمَ عَلَى سُورَةِ, is there in the hadith. And the hadith, تَخَلَّقُ بِأَخْلَاقِ اللَّهِ, acquire the qualities of God. And in certain mystical thinkers like Ibn Arabi and Ghazali, that becomes really important, where you have the saint as the mazhar, the place where the 99 names of God are represented. If you look at that, then you can actually bring together the two ideas. If you look, for instance, at Ghazali's book on the 99 names, and his idea of what is a perfect human being, and at, say, Thomas Aquinas, where he talks about the divine names of St. Denis the Areopagite, he says something very similar about being assimilated to the qualities of God. And there's a certain basis of, in both traditions, in Plato, in that. If you do that, then you can say, actually, the two men are not as different as some polemicists and activists have claimed. Because to be perfect, you have to represent not just some of the divine qualities, but all of them. And necessarily, although the Gospels give the impression that Jesus is just, turning the other cheek, and pacifist, and meek, and mild, and there's none of the rigor there, if you look at his role at the end time, that's when he comes with the rod of iron, and he instantiates God's justice. That's when the qualities of jalal, of rigor, are present in the perfection of Jesus. In the Islamic context, you find a lot of jalal, the rigor, in the prophet's combating with his idolatrous neighbors. The ghazawat and the jihad is a rigorous principle. At the end of time, the prophet comes as rahmatan lil alameen, a mercy to the world. The prophet comes at the end of time not to condemn, but to plead for people's salvation, which is the shafa'ah. So if you put together the big picture of this worldly and the next worldly, which traditional believers always did because they're always preoccupied with the end of time, you find actually that the two figures do have the divine qualities both perfectly represented in them. But because they were in different contexts, the context of Roman occupation in Palestine required a different sort of response to the context of lawlessness in 7th century Arabia. But if you look at the bigger picture, you find that they're actually much more similar than a lot of more narrow-minded believers have wanted to think.
Yeah, I'm curious, I'm interested in your second point on the handout, and I'm curious to what extent you think the, this is the point about Semitism, contrasted with Christian intellectuality, whether the rise of the evangelical movement, which is obviously very committed to law and the book, versus also the rise of regional Islamic movements around the world, makes this distinction relevant, or irrelevant, rather.
Okay, no, I like that. Yes, it's. I don't know that much about the American evangelical world, except that there is a subset amongst American evangelicals. And in this country, we have a nasty tendency to assume that they're all mad Republicans who want to ride cruise missiles into Baghdad. And the reality is they're not all like that. But there is a subset amongst them called Dominionists, who believe that the Bible should be the only source of legislation in the U.S. And there's maybe 5 or 6 million of them. And they do look a little bit like this kind of law-oriented Semitic quality. And where that possibility has appeared in Christian history, it's often been dismissed as a Judaizing tendency. So Christians who at the time of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation thought that they should practice circumcision and observe the dietary laws were referred to by the mainline churches as Judaizers. Bossuet, for instance, in his Discourse on Universal History, calls some of the Hussites Judaizers, precisely because they are bringing in this dimension of law. But you're right, and I admit that I've been speaking in terms of huge generalizations this evening, because otherwise you can't begin to get the comparisons underway. But it's true that there is a strong subset of American evangelicalism that does believe in law, and that John Ashcroft, the former Attorney General, when he took office, he had himself baptized, anointed with holy oil, which was a kind of strange thing to happen in the Justice Department. But there are evangelicals who think in those terms.
What does the Quran say about forgiveness and salvation and the afterlife? How does it compare with Christianity and Judaism?
Similar to Judaism in that there is the idea of repentance, teshuvah, the Jewish idea of turning penitently back towards God. Tauba is the Quranic word, and the two are very closely connected etymologically. The idea that if you turn back to God in sincere repentance, he will certainly wipe out whatever sin it was that you committed. Different from Judaism in that Judaism has historically not been so interested in an afterlife. There are exceptions because Judaism is a diverse tradition. There are some Jews who believe in reincarnation, others who do believe in heaven, some kind of hell, but certainly not to the extent that you find it in the Quran, which is very big on heaven and hell and occupies a good proportion of the text. Those two traditions do contrast quite substantially with the Christian idea, which is that salvation is really by grace and that human action cannot go any way towards paying off the debt which we owe God. The narrative of human sin is very different. Christianity has been historically much keener to stress human sinfulness than have either Judaism or Islam. The idea of original sin, that is to say that we don't just have a tendency to sin, but we've inherited the guilt of the sin of Adam, is something that Islam and Judaism have consistently rejected. So the human predicament really is not so much sin as just being forgetful. We forget God, we forget what we should do. And the principle of the divine is that God is forgiving. And the prophet intercedes, as I said, for sinners at the end of time. And the idea that God will only forgive human beings if a debt is repaid, to Muslims and Jews doesn't really look like forgiveness. It's like the repayment of a debt. If my neighbour owes me £1,000, I can either write it off, or I can say I want it back. And if you say you want it back, then that's not the same as forgiveness. If you say, I don't care, I'm just going to scratch it out, That's forgiveness, and that's the Judaic and Islamic idea of how God operates, which is actually, it shouldn't be too far from the Christian image, because Jesus' own teaching was there in the parable of the prodigal son, which doesn't have anything really about the vicarious atonement or the repayment of a debt. The beauty of that story is that the father just forgives him because he's come back penitent. So again, that gets back to Hans Kung's point, that once you get back to the original Judaic teachings of Jesus, these religions start to look quite similar.
I just suddenly became very curious about the origins of this belief. Well, you just mentioned that there is something in the Christian tradition about where there is just forgiveness without any clause or condition.
Yep.
So now I've just suddenly become very curious as to where this, what the origins of this belief are, that there does need to be some sort of place.
Well, it's implicit in part of the Gospels, particularly in John's Gospel, and it's certainly St. Paul's idea of how God saves. That there has to be a sacrifice, because the inherited guilt of human beings is infinite, because Adam's crime against God was infinite, and therefore finite human repentance can never deal with that. That's just juggling with the law, and it can never be enough, because the law is what we do, and it's just finite. Only God's own sacrifice can be infinite enough to atone for the original infinite sin. That's kind of the Augustinian view. There are other Christian views. A lot of Anglicans now wouldn't take that view. They would say that Christ's sacrifice deals with sin by manifesting God's love. They wouldn't say that it's literally the payment of a blood debt. But in Catholic and some evangelical circles, that still is the image. But it really comes from St. Paul.
Thank you for your talk. Could you please comment a bit about the status of Jerusalem?
Right.
Is it accurate to say that it's the holiest site of Islam? And if you do say that, does it follow on that it is a haram in the sense that Mecca and Medina?
Yeah, it's a matter of ijma, or consensus in Islamic law, that Jerusalem is the third of the holy cities, that it's a haram which has its own delineation, that it contains within itself the Masjid al-Aqsa, the mosque which is mentioned in the Quran, which is, of course, has the golden dome on it now. And that it was the place where the earlier prophets worshipped, is the place where the holy prophet ascended from earth up to the presence of God on the night of the ascension. And the sound hadith also indicate that a prayer done in that mosque, in that haram, that sanctuary, is worth 500 times more than a prayer done anywhere else, except for the mosques in Mecca and Medina. So it's not a contested issue amongst Muslims, it's the holy city.
I've just got a quick question. Would it be correct to say that as Muslims we believe that Jesus mentioned Muhammad?
Right.
The Bible and sees some quotes where it says that, you know, after he will come to Muhammad. And I've read in places that the Muslim scholars believe that the translation of the Bible would actually be Muhammad.
Okay. Yeah, one of the things that the Quran reports Jesus as having said is that he describes himself as وَمُبَشِّرًا بِرَسُولٍ يَتِّي بَعْدِي إِسْمُهُ أَحْمَدٍ. I bring the good news of a messenger who will come after me, whose name will be the most praiseworthy, which is Ahmad. In other words, an individual of the enunciatory power of Jesus must have known that there was going to be an event of such enormous significance to the history of monotheism as Islam, and that's one of the things that he did. When you look in the Gospels that we have today for an indication that he was predicting the arrival of another messenger, Muslims have been very keen to find such texts. And the passage in John's Gospel about the Paraclete, the Comforter, has often been mobilized by Muslims as an example of that. However, it's also the case that Muslims are very keen to undermine the authority of John's Gospel as something of a late text of unknowable authorship. So sometimes we try to have our cake and eat it, and it doesn't really add up. But the Paraclete in John's Gospel almost certainly refers to some kind of a spiritual sustenance or comfort that will come to the believers. Although most modern historians of early Christianity will say that early Christians didn't believe in the divinity of the Holy Spirit. It came later. But to say, as a lot of Muslims, probably most Muslims do, that that certainly is a proof text indicating that Jesus was predicting the rise of Islam is forcing the texts, I think. It's rather like a lot of Christians who want to find anticipations of the divinity of Jesus in the Old Testament. If you really want to find the texts, you can find them. You can prove, if you want, that Abraham believed in the Trinity, but a lot of Jewish readers of the text won't be terribly impressed.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you all.